Well, Kyle, whenever you are ready.
Yep, I was just going to go ahead and unmute and get started. Hopefully, our other members roll in as they're ready. So we'll start. Welcome to our Solid Waste Meeting Advisory Commission for November 4th. We'll start with a, I'll just do a quick roll call. So I'm here. Tim, the Vice Chair, is here. We have Jason present as well. Alan, Rich, and like that is it for the advisory commission. Do we have any questions? Or we'll start with the approval of last meeting minutes that Amber presented via email. Does anyone have any questions about anything in there or want to make a motion to approve?
I make a motion to approve.
Second.
All right, second. Perfect. And raise your hand to approve. Okay. Minutes are approved as presented. We will move into the second item on our agenda. We have all the updates from our different partners. We're going to start with the solid waste program. Amber, since Travis is in here, who's heading that up? That can be you or Mike or...
I'll go ahead and take care of that. We have, at the moment, I know that we did send out all of our meeting notes, our staff updates earlier. And beyond that, the only thing that I think I'm going to mention at the moment is we have offered the operations specialist position to a gal by the name of Molly Mangarich. This will be the position that Kim Harless formerly held. Molly will begin on November 22nd. She comes to us with more than 26 years of experience in the solid waste industry. She has previous SWAC experience as both a member and a facilitator. She will be stepping in to help me out, and at some point in the future, she and I will both be handling these much in the way that Kim and I used to handle them together. And beyond that, any questions you have, you can send an email to Travis, will be back next week, or myself, and we can address them with the rest of the staff as needed.
Okay, thank you, Amber. We're going to move on to our Clark County Enforcement with Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
Hello, how's everyone doing? Can everyone? Pardon? I'm Melissa Sutton. I'm with Clark County Public Health. I'm the Solid Waste Coordinator. This month, I celebrate 18 years with Clark County Public Health. So I've been in this position for quite some time, for those of you who I'm not familiar with. Brian Schlottman is out for this SWAC. He just welcomed a baby girl in October. So Luna Ray has joined the Schlottman family. So I'm going to attempt to share my screen. So please bear with me as this is not something that I do every day. And I grab the right one. So I won't give a ton of updates. I know that everyone received the quarterly report for Q3, so this is kind of just a quick summary. We received 45 complaints and resolved 42. I conducted all 11 permitted facility inspections, and in Q3, anticipating Brian Schlottman going on paternity leave, I thought I should get all of those done this quarter too. So I went ahead and got those done in case we ran into any problems that he would be aware of them before he left. So this quarter, we did not receive these permit applications, but we became aware of these, I guess, all them situations. So I'll update you on those next. So we have a new potential permitted site. So this impacts SWAC, because if they do, when they do submit their permit application, part of the process is the Solid Waste Advisory Commission recommendation. We received a call from City of Battleground that they are looking to expand and modify their decant facility, to which I responded, what decant facility? So they graciously allowed an inspection with Ecology and myself, and we said, this should have been permitted the whole time. We had no idea. In Whatley Pit Decamp Facilities Operation Plan, they have City of Battleground listed as one of their clients. So we have, and City of Battleground does dispose of their decant and street sweeping material. They kind of decant it here at this facility in Battleground, but then they truck it to Whatley for disposal and handling. So it's a little bit unique. They are applying for a grant through Washington State Department of Ecology, and that grant process triggered them to contact public health, and they will be needing a solid waste permit.
So, to be clear, the decant facility is built and operational?
Yes.
And now they're coming through for their permits. So if we say no when it comes to SWAC, then what happens?
That is a very interesting situation. So they're actually not looking for a permit approval for the existing operation. They're looking to expand what they currently are doing. So part of the review, it's interesting that I'm going to have to review a plan that for the existing facility and then concurrently review a plan for what they have proposed.
How come the City of Battleground has to get approval from Clark County?
Clark County Public Health has regulatory jurisdiction through Washington State Department of Ecology and is given that statutory authority to issue solid waste handling permits for all
inside and outside of city limits.
Both. Public health has jurisdiction inside municipalities and outside.
Okay. And so those pictures are the actual facility.
This is the actual facility, what is there today. And those pictures were taken on September 30th when I did an inspection. They also have some piles of inert material and some wood waste piles that those piles fall under an exemption status. So we did request that they start their process by submitting the NOI for that wood waste asphalt and small amount of metals that they have. But they will need to submit a complete application. The completed application requires SEPA approved, like it has to go through the whole SEPA process. So that'll have to be done through City of Battleground as the lead. And that will be that, like, their community development battleground, not the public works who's applying for the permit.
Right, right.
Melissa, is this site that we're looking at in the City of Battleground or in the county?
It is in the City of Battleground at the City of Battleground Operations Center for City of Battleground Public Works.
Okay.
The address is 1308 Southeast Grace Avenue in Battleground.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can you see the screen that I'm sharing?
Oh, yeah. There.
Okay. Yeah, the address is on there, too. So if you needed to jot it down or wanted to jot down, like, text person, mm-hmm. I did provide that as well.
We always appreciate your ideas about it, though.
Oh, yeah. It's very small scale what they do. They really just have one truck that manages their street sweeping and their decant. So, and I don't foresee them expanding it to allow other municipalities to dispose of materials there. It's unique in that what they're doing currently, it doesn't really, they're managing the solid waste there, but they're not actually ending up with a good plan or solution for disposal. So they don't have an end use. Their end is to just go to Whatley, which Whatley, as you know, isn't an end use either. They have to then further take it to a landfill. So I don't know why. I'm hopeful through this permitting process that City of Battleground can just end up taking it to either go through the waste connection system through a drop box type situation or just take it to the landfill themselves rather than going to an intermediary facility.
How does the city benefit by building their own? Do they get a grant to do this? I mean, there can't be that much less that they haul to Whatley by just decanting this stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem that they have that much material that they process there, which it was a bit surprising that they even have a facility there.
Yeah.
It's, I think, just the trucking and convenience that they can, you know, pile up, you know, 4 or 5 days worth.
Right.
Truckload, you know, let it decant and then take the dried materials or somewhat dried materials to Whatley. Rather than just taking, you know, truck after, you know, a single truck every single day to Whatley, they can just take one once a week or maybe once every other week.
So they can't store undecanted material. No, I guess they really can't, can they? Because then you'd be bleeding out all over the place.
Yeah, they have two sides. And what you see in the left, the picture to the left, there's like a pile inside of that facility there. And that, it's co-located with their wastewater treatment lagoon. And so what you see there smelled quite horrific. I think it was sludge from their lagoon there that they were holding. And so I talked to them about odors and odor management. They're doing, I think it's called Staten Road. I think they're going to end up doing a road through there nearby. And so it's not really built up right now, so not creating a nuisance, but I could see in the future that it could potentially. So
I can keep asking questions about this, but let me go for now.
Yeah, I just don't have a lot of information right now. It really was one of those things of I had no idea you were doing this, so let's try to see you.
How long has this been built?
They said it's been there about 10 years. So I'm not quite sure why they would think that Whatley Pit would need a permit, but not them, when they built this 10 years ago. It's really, really tucked back on their property. There is no way that you would know it was there if you weren't invited to their property. So it's just unique. So that's coming down the pike.
Well, check on its expansion, because it doesn't look like the little bit that they're playing with that they need to expand it for.
Well, they're getting a grant application to expand, and I think that they do have high hopes. And with City of Battleground growing so exponentially, just population, I foresee them needing a larger facility, especially if they're looking to stockpile any volume of materials. City of Washougal, as you may remember, they put in their own decant facility back in 2016. And I've encouraged City of Battleground to contact City of Washougal and talk to them about their engineer and their operations plan and what works for them and what doesn't, and kind of try to go from there. So we're hoping to have at least the first draft of the permit by the end of the year. And then that will be for Derek Rocket with Ecology and myself. We'll review it for completeness. And then once it's deemed complete, then the clock starts and we have 90 days to make a recommendation to approve or deny the application.
Thank you.
Yeah. So probably February, and we might need to have a special meeting for that permit discussion, just an FYI. While I was out at City of Battleground Operations Center, this picture in here looks directly across the street from their operations center. So as I was pulling out, I thought, huh, that's an awful big pile of inert material at that property there, and I don't know anything about that. So I paid them a visit. It turns out to be Three Kings Environmental. I left my business card as no one was there. They spoke with Derek Rocket at Ecology. They've completed a notice of intent for solid waste exemption for materials, concrete, asphalt, and brick to be stockpiled and crushed on site. We sent that out for multi-agency review on the 14th. We received it on the 14th, sent it for multi-agency review on the 22nd. And I'm awaiting comments through the 8th. So I heard back from from Southwest Clean Air Agency that they do have a crushing permit. So
do they have a crusher?
They do have a crusher.
Or do they lease one?
I don't know if they lease it or not. I just know that Southwest Clean Air is happy with whatever their requirements are, that they don't need anything additional. So whether it's leased or it's their own, it's approved through Southwest Clean Air.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new exempt facility coming on board. And then kind of an update on Section 30 PIT. As you may remember, back in, I think, January, maybe 19, maybe 20, it all runs together in my head now, but they had wanted to do a compost facility, and it got shut down by the public, as you may recall. I went out and did my annual inspection on the 23rd, and I observed a large pile of wood waste material there, and much to my surprise, they said, oh, it's not yard debris. And I said, oh, okay, wood waste then. And they said, oh, no, it's feedstock. Like, feedstock for what? Oh, we got this new biochar technology, and we're going to start making biochar with this feedstock. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds a lot like burning. And have you talked to Southwest Clean Air Agency? So I've gotten to learn a lot about biochar since the 23rd of September. And we've had some meetings with Southwest Clean Air. Clint Lamoureux has indicated that they will need an air quality permit. That also will need to go through the whole SEPA process. It also needs an EPA permit. And Clint indicated that that permit runs $10,000 to $20,000 a year for the annual permit to operate that equipment. So Public Health and Ecology have requested Section 30 PIT folks, Tappany, to update and modify their notice of intent for the exemption to allow them to have piles of wood waste at this property, not to compost, but just to have the piles. And then, I left out the section. Sorry. I had another slide that has, there is a section in the code that allows for, if it's determined to be an incinerator or energy recovery, if it is only wood waste materials, they can qualify under exemption status and not require a solid waste handling permit for this activity, provided that they only manage and maintain the materials approved through Southwest Clean Air Agency for their air quality permit.
So will they bury the biochar then, or what will they do with it?
Nope, they're planning to sell the biochar as final, like as a final product, so much like, you know, they would sell bark or soil amendments. There's a really high demand right now for biochar. It's kind of the new like buzzword, and you know, it's like green, kind of a buzzword, green word that I had not heard of until a month ago. But there's a lot of projects that are requiring like 15% biochar in their blends and in soil blends for soil amendments and additives. And they're getting, like a lot of government jobs are giving preference to those companies who can provide biochar, similar to like what you would have in like a green building program, if that makes sense. So that's kind of coming up. Coincidentally, I received another call from another operator inquiring about biochar and biochar technology to see if it's approved and what they would need. And so I kind of gave them the rundown on what Tappany is going through. So they decided that they will hold off on their acquiring of technology until Tappany has maybe vetted that process a little bit. So that should be interesting. And then an update to our Clark County Code. We are currently in the public comment period. We put it out to the public in October. We've updated our website and the information is available at clark.wa.gov/public-health/solid-waste-garbage. We're accepting public comment through December 31st. And on our website, you'll find information which has the electronic online survey link, which is very similar to what was provided to SWAC and our stakeholders prior. There's a link to the current code, and then there's a PDF of the proposed code revision so that folks can see it all as a document if that's easier for them. So we're just trying to make sure to give everyone everything that they might want and give them easy access for that.
Have you had any nibbles?
All of the comments go to Brian, and he's out of the office since December 1st. So when he gets back on December 1st, I'll find out, but I haven't heard anything yet.
Okay, just tell us, you know, how much, it looks like a lot of effort goes into this, and then, of course, it's required, but then how much, you know, how many people take advantage of it?
Yeah, and we have tried to resend it out to some of our stakeholders who maybe didn't get an opportunity to complete it during the initial review. We're trying to put it on Facebook and we're reaching out. Brian has made concerted efforts to reach out to our diversity and inclusion committee to also reach out to some other community organizations that might have some other outreaches beyond kind of our standard, put it on the website, put it on in the paper and hope for the best. So we're trying to have a broad swath, but again, it who knows how many people will take time to comment. So Brian and I do initial review of comments and recommendations January, February, and anticipate next spring to do some Board of County Council workshops.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you all so much.
All right, thank you, Melissa. Appreciate all the updates. Got some interesting situations on deck. So looking for some updates on those as we move forward. Next up, we have Julie with City of Vancouver doing her update. Welcome, Julie.
Good evening. It's great to see everyone. I'll give you a couple of high-level updates. I apologize we didn't have those ready for summary in advance. Since our last meeting, we wrapped up our seasonal spring yard debris and tire coupon program. Similar to what we did in 2020, we extended that seasonal program an additional month, so it ran through the full month of July. That was to provide Vancouver customers with an additional month to take advantage of their benefit in recognition of the pandemic potentially impacting their ability to get to the yard debris disposal sites. This benefit is provided by City of Vancouver ratepayers, and it's a benefit back to City of Vancouver single-family households with active garbage service. That program cost us about $80,000 this year, and over 3,400 customers redeemed, or excuse me, 3,465 coupons were redeemed. Almost 7,000 cubic yards of yard debris was processed through that program, and over 1,000 tires disposed of. And then we also wrapped up our second year of providing an additional benefit to our community. We offered a bulky item pickup option to our customers subscribed with active garbage service inside City of Vancouver limits. And this was in lieu of our traditional neighborhood cleanup events. Before the pandemic, we offered over 50 neighborhood cleanup events scheduled from March through November over the course of Saturday weekends, serving the broad customer base with our neighborhoods in partnership with our neighborhood associations and Waste Connections. But due to the pandemic and restrictions in health and safety, we transitioned that program and benefit to a curbside service. So this is our second year offering a pickup at the curb. The cost for the program is relatively lower because we're serving in a different capacity in a different manner. The disposal costs alone were just under $11,000 of disposal bulky items. Residents had up to 5 items that they could choose to set out at no additional cost to them. We removed over 104 tons of bulky items from the customer base and served 1,798 customers. So it's about 4% of our eligible customer base. And we don't measure participation in traditional cleanup events. So the best comparison we have is activity on the neighborhood cleanup events is participation by neighborhood. And then this alternative benefit really does measure the household participation level of 4%, if that makes sense. And we anticipate offering a hybrid next year for 2022. So with our next SWAC update, I should have more to offer. What we're finding is it was a successful program in that it provided a different style of service in meeting our customers' bulky item needs. In some ways, a higher level of service, customers didn't have to drive to a common collection point within their neighborhood, but it still required them to opt in and hear about the program. So it's a balancing act of making sure our customer base is aware of the benefits to them. The fabric of our community is often built around neighborhood cleanup events. So we recognize the value to our neighborhood associations in providing cleanups and hope to have a hybrid option where safe to do so in 2022. So we're excited to continue to evolve and still help meet our community's need for bulky disposal. And just in the beginning of October, we launched the annual Fall Leaves Coupon Program. And that's a regional program that Vancouver administers in partnership with our partners at Clark County, Public Works, Public Health. And we provide free disposal of leaves to residents all across the county at 4 yard debris processing sites. And so that program's a favorite. It's over 20 years in offering. And highlight every year, especially when we get this windy weather that brings a lot of leaves down. And then also Vancouver offers a neighborhood leaf box program where we provide drop boxes within leafy neighborhoods across 8 weekends, November through December, to again facilitate getting leaves out of the street, facilitate getting them composted and convenient access for our community where we have a great deal of leaves. And I'm excited to share with SWAC tonight, Vancouver was awarded in July $40,000 from the State Department of Ecology for a Community Litter Cleanup Program grant. That's the CLCP grant. This grant was created through recent legislation, Senate Bill 5040, the Welcome to Washington Litter Cleanup Act, and it allows Vancouver to clean up litter along state highway on and off ramps within the city of Vancouver limits. So that $40,000 will be applied over 2 years, and working coordinated work with our Washington State Department of Transportation, as well as partners across the city and Clark County as well. We conducted 3 cleanup events in September and October in partnership with Clark County District Court Community Restitution Crews. They were a great partner in helping us remove over almost half a ton of litter and debris from the ramps. We cleaned 6 ramps, removed 143 bags of litter, 62 bags of illegal dumping, and 14 bags of clean recyclables. And due to the recent state COVID-19 mandate, we will now be transitioning this project. We can no longer use the community restitution crews, and we'll have to work with pre-registered trained volunteers in future cleanup events. And we'll have more information to share once we have our next events planned. And then in conclusion, Vancouver is taking our annual solid waste rate review to our City Council for consideration for adoption of proposed rates that will take effect January 1st, 2022. And you might have seen, if you read the Columbian Legal section, we post a legal ad on Wednesday and this coming Wednesday as well. We'll be at Council on Monday, the 8th, and the following 15th of November will be our public hearing on our rates. And that's all from me. Were there any questions?
I'm glad I've participated in several of those cleanups of the ramps, especially around Legacy Hospital, of course, which is not in the county, but, you know, it's the same garbage all the time. And that seems like a good use of our money. And I hope to volunteer when I would, but please advertise that really well.
There's a process. It sounds like you might have been an Adopt-a-Highway volunteer or Adopt-a-Road volunteer. So to merge our efforts, we have a litter stewards program that was launched during the COVID pandemic with our volunteer program in Vancouver. And really, our community is excited to see litter, see anyone acting on litter. So we're providing a means through which we can act on litter. Meanwhile, also educating our community about litter being a preventable thing. Both intentional or unintentional, and then securing loads too.
The Washington State Highway Department has all kinds of stuff for you to borrow if you want to borrow, orange jackets and pickup things and bags and everything too. So you don't have to spend all the money buying new stuff. They've got it too.
Yes, thank you. They've been a terrific partner. We definitely have partnered with them for this work. Thank you. Any other questions or thoughts?
Yeah, Julie, I had one question about the rate increase proposals. What kind of percentage are you looking at in terms of, like, garbage and recycling and all
that? Yeah, certainly.
She didn't say increase. She just said rate change. I assume it's a rate change.
In some cases, it's an adjustment, right? An adjustment. What goes into Vancouver rates is, what we call the inflation adjustment factor, which considers fuel costs and inflationary costs. And then other factors that Vancouver doesn't influence, say our disposal tip fee. But when you take all those factors combined, our rate impact is about 2.1 to 2.4. If the rounding for one rate is 2.4, most of it is 2.1 to 2.3. What that means for, say, the average single-family household, the average customer in Vancouver, when you account for other changes in our rate adjustments, such as a reduction in recycling processing surcharge, that's a pass-through to our customer base, it's actually going to be less than 1%. It would be 0.6% of an impact increase. So as the dollars shake out, it just depends on the service level, but for most Vancouver customers, it'll be a very modest increase of less than 1%.
Great. Good to hear.
Thank you.
All right. Have a wonderful meeting. Thank you.
Thanks for updating us. Okay. Next up, we would have Waste Connections, but I don't see Derek on our list. Amber, yep, you're shaking your head no. So we're going to move on to Paul Jewell from the Washington Association of County Solid Waste Managers. And Paul is just going to give us a little overview of what they do and talk about some upcoming things on the legislative agenda. Thanks for joining us, Paul. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. Are you hearing me okay all the way out here from Ellensburg, Washington? Fantastic. Well, thanks for inviting me. Like I said, my name is Paul Jewell. I'm a policy director with the Washington State Association of Counties. One of our affiliate groups is the Washington Association of County Solid Waste Managers, and I work very closely with that group on a regular, really daily basis. I handle water, land use, natural resources, and other environmental issues for the association. We represent all 39 counties in Washington State, and solid waste issues are part of that portfolio. But as you can see, it's only one of many issues that I have direct responsibility for. We work directly with legislators during the legislative session. We work with our members like Clark County, like you guys, and we work a lot with state agencies on a variety of different issues across the state. Travis asked me and Amber asked me to come to you today and just kind of talk about what we do from a policy advocacy point of view, kind of give you the rundown on how that works, and then maybe talk about some of the legislation and some of the policy issues that we're dealing with today and what you can kind of expect or maybe look forward to if you want to look at it more optimistically. I do apologize for the lighting in here. I'm at my home office in Ellensburg, and it is really heavily influenced by natural light. And being that it's 6:30 in the evening, there's not much natural light here, and it's not very well lit at other times of the day, so I apologize for that. I'm really a much better looking guy than this. You'll just have to take my word. So I'll give you kind of a rundown really quickly on policy work that we do and how it's structured. So At the Washington State Association of Counties, I did mention that all counties are members of our association. We're one of the only statewide associations that can brag that everyone is a member, which is really great. It's really valuable. But as you know, counties are very different across the state of Washington. Clark County is one of our larger members. But we have, you know, we have members from King County and Clark County and all up and down the I-5 corridor and all across the state of Washington, including, you know, some of our smaller members in more remote places like Northeast Washington and Southeast Washington. Some of our counties are so small that they have less than 8,000 residents in the entire county. And when you go from, you know, the millions of residents in King County to less than 8,000, say in Garfield County or Columbia County, surprisingly enough, they don't always agree on everything. There's a variety of opinions, right? And there's a lot of differences in those communities and what they want and what they expect. And it's my job to kind of take all those opinions in and figure out how we're going to advocate on a statewide level for the county system as a whole, which can be really challenging, but also really fun. One of our affiliate groups, we have several affiliate groups for different types of work that counties do. And one of those groups is the Washington Association of County Solid Waste Managers. I mentioned them earlier. That's one of the groups that I'm assigned to. We formed that group, I believe, in 2018. So it's a fairly new group. But they've been working really hard to get organized, and they've been really energetic and great to work with. I didn't mention I'm also a former county commissioner, so I had some experience working in solid waste, but not at the level that I do now. And I never knew that that solid waste professionals were as fun and as exciting and as interesting as they are. I have to tell you, for all the groups that I deal with, the solid waste group is the best by far. They're always energetic. They always show up, and they really know how to party afterwards. But that's a secret that we'll keep amongst ourselves. Amber knows what I'm talking about. She's raising the roof over there. So one of the things that we work with the group on is really kind of honing our policy. And we do that a couple of different ways. We have regular meetings. Obviously, since the pandemic has hit, just like you, we're meeting virtually with the group frequently. We meet with them monthly. When the pandemic started, we actually were meeting with them weekly. Before that, we were really meeting with the group in person on in regional meetings on a quarterly basis. Those meetings include all kinds of different things where we just share information. We share some of our concerns, some of our issues, what we might be working on so that we can really take advantage of the knowledge base that exists across the board and share resources and information that way. But we also get really deep on policy issues, and we talk about operational problems. We talk about business models. We talk about contracts. We talk about the legal framework of solid waste. We talk about solid waste planning. We talk about solid waste enforcement. It was great to hear everything that's going on with your enforcement folks in the report earlier today from Public Health. You know, they are really, in many ways, some of the unsung heroes in solid waste. Their job largely goes unnoticed because they do such a good job. But boy, if they failed, we certainly would be, you know, doing a lot of finger pointing. And obviously, that's not happening. So they're doing a great job. And we talk a lot about the programs that you just heard about with the city of Vancouver as well. But we also talk about, you know, broader things like, you know, how to fund solid waste on a statewide level. Operationally, you know, what should recycling look like? We were very involved in a lot of the China sword impacts, et cetera. And in those conversations, we actually developed what we call policy documents or our guiding principles documents. And those are actually written policies that everyone in the group agrees on that really help shape and guide our advocacy work and our policy work as an organization. So believe it or not, we're able to get all 39 counties to come together and agree on some words on the paper that say, okay, if proposals come forward like this, here's our priorities. Here's what we're going to advocate for. If proposals come forward like this, you know, we're going to advocate in this way. Now, there are some things that we can't agree on, and so we leave that oftentimes up to individual members to advocate on their own. But we work really, really hard to find areas of agreement, especially in big, broad policy issues like recycling, like producer responsibility programs, like, you know, solid waste enforcement, like trying to think of some other big ones. They'll come to mind, I'm sure, where we can actually have a coherent position and we can try to do our best on a statewide level to make sure that when agencies are imposing rules or regulations, or when legislators are thinking about new proposals, that your voice as individual solid waste advisory committees and as counties is heard on a statewide level. And that's really the work that I do. I advocate personally and work personally with those folks on a daily basis, and then I help coordinate our members when we need to have, you know, a bigger push on a legislative issue where perhaps we'll organize a group of members, and your county's been very involved in this, on testifying on certain pieces of legislation. Or maybe we'll do an advocacy day in Olympia during the session where we organize a bunch of members and we make appointments with key decision makers, including legislators on the Senate and House sides, and staff members, and we actually go through from office to office, and we essentially lobby on your behalf. That's pretty much how it works on our end. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any before I kind of move on to other stuff.
Paul, is there any discussion between counties? Like our Ridgefield area is really close to College County, and it might be a whole bunch easier to haul our garbage to College County's dump than it is to all the way down to the river and put it through the berm. And then, you know, this never seems to occur to anybody that, you know, you could cross the county lines, or maybe we should haul stuff to Idaho or wherever, you know, if it's closer because of the high fuel cost now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of interaction between counties, and there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, having those types of conversations. Of course, your service providers are going to be pretty involved in those conversations as well, right? They have relationships with different landfills. They have relationships with other service providers. And I assume that that's going to be part of those discussions. I don't know the details of, the way your contracts are currently set up. I'm sure Amber and Travis can give you more insight there. So I don't know why you haul it down, and barge it out versus sending it to Cowlitz County. But there are opportunities for those discussions to occur, for sure. In fact, that's one of the big values of being a part of the association, are those networking opportunities.
Thank you.
You bet. We also do a lot of sharing electronically. You know, every time you guys have an opening, it goes out to every county as far as a job opening, right? That's something that we share because those are professional opportunities that we want everybody to be aware of. Every time you guys have a question about a contract negotiation, or maybe you're developing a new program and you want to know if it's been done in other counties, we send that information out as well, and people respond back and forth. So it's a useful tool for our members in general, and certainly for me and for individual counties. So moving on, I thought I'd talk a little bit about, some of the policy issues that we've been dealing with over the last couple of years. You've seen lots of legislative activity, lots of policy activity dealing with solid waste, connected to the China sword impacts, connected to environmental goals of the state of Washington, connected to the climate change issues that we're also dealing with, and some of the big pieces of legislation there. It has manifested itself in a variety of different ways. One of our big initiatives, before I get into some of those others, over the last few years has really been on funding. You probably know that your statewide funding support was cut dramatically in 2013. This is the funding that comes from the MOTCA account, the Model Toxics Control Act. There's a tax that's placed on hazardous substances that come into Washington State. It's primarily funded by oil products, like gasoline, motor oil, that sort of stuff. There are other products as well, but the majority of the funding comes from petroleum-based products. There's been a lot of dipping into that fund by state agencies and others over the last several years, especially during the Great Recession. And a lot of our funds that we receive through the local solid waste financial assistance account, formerly the CPG or coordinated prevention grants account, that go towards your operations, towards essentially implementing what's in your comprehensive solid waste management plan. Those funds were cut by over 62% in 2013, and they were never restored. And so one of the big initiatives by the group since its inception was to try to get those monies restored. And it took several years, but last year we were actually successful and we got a 140% increase ongoing, so a permanent increase moving forward in those funds. So we were able to restore that account from $10 million statewide to $24 million statewide on a biennial basis. And Clark County was a direct recipient of a large portion of those funds. So that was a really nice success story for our members and probably the biggest win that they've gotten since their creation, but they've only been in the business for a couple of years. So they're doing quite well to get $14 million and 140% increase in that short period of time. So I'm really proud of that accomplishment. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. Other than that, we've been dealing with other policy issues, some of which you've, I'm sure, heard of, like the restrictions on carry-out plastic bags. I'm sure you're noticing a lot heavier weight plastic bag in your local grocery stores than you did in the past. Those are actually recyclable, right? They're not the same film type bags that you were seeing previously. And if your communities did have a bag fee in place, that has now been replaced by the statewide fee that everyone pays in Washington State. So that was a big issue that has recently, that was passed a couple of years ago and has recently been implemented. Another big one that you've probably heard about is the paint stewardship bill. That was passed a couple of years ago. I'm sure you guys dealt with the contracts and the logistics associated with getting that program up and running. That was something that we worked on as well. There was a food recovery bill passed in 2018. There was an industrial symbiosis bill that maybe flew a little bit more under the radar that was finally passed last year. That was a good bill. And we've seen other things like that. We've also dealt with proposals around banning of single-use drinking straws. Remember those? That whole discussion? Remember the pictures of the turtles with the straws stuck up their nose and that sort of thing? That was an interesting hearing. Believe it or not, that was one of the most controversial hearings of the year in 2019. And you had some really interesting testimony on all sides of that issue. And it was really the disability community that ended up killing that bill because they really need those flexible plastic straws from an accessibility point of view for those folks who have handicaps that they're dealing with and they need accommodations. We also saw some bills around EPR packaging or product responsibility proposals for packaging. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. We saw some bills around litter control, organic waste management, and things like that, many of which are still kind of in the pipeline, and we expect those to come back. What we're dealing with now, and what I think we're going to be talking about a lot during the upcoming legislative session, are really kind of three things. We're going to be talking about plastics a lot. We talked about that last year in Senate Bill 5022, which passed. If you remember that bill, it included like three major things. There was a ban on certain styrofoam polystyrene, expanded polystyrene products. So like the clamshell kind of food containers, the really inexpensive coolers that you'd buy in the grocery stores, packing peanuts, that sort of stuff. That stuff has now been banned in Washington State. And that bill also included some new requirements for single-use utensils and condiments that you might get at restaurants. You have to ask for those now, or they can put them out on kind of an a la carte station where you can go get them. They can't just give them to you anymore in your takeout or carryout bag. You have to actually ask for those. But it also included some new requirements for post-consumer content in certain plastic containers. Specifically bottles, so beverage bottles, like, you know, water bottles, soda bottles, that sort of thing. It included some post-consumer content requirements in plastic containers for household cleaning products and for household personal care products. So like shampoo bottles or maybe the, you know, Clorox bleach spray bottle, things like that. And that it also included some minimum content for post-consumer material in trash bags. And these are going to be implemented over time. But the bill also asked for a statewide advisory committee to be formed to look at post-consumer content regulation requirements for other plastics as well. And that work has been going on during what we call the interim, which is the several months between sessions. There's been a work group formed, and they're working on some post-consumer content or PCR requirements that we're likely to see in some legislation moving forward. As an association, we're pretty supportive of implementing minimum post-consumer content requirements for plastics. We want there to be a market for the materials that we actually collect in our recycling programs. We want there to actually be real recycling occurring, not phantom or ghost recycling that really was just putting items on a barge and shipping them, you know, over to Asian countries where they were disposed of in a different way. You know, that was very misleading, and frankly, while it worked economically for Washington State residents and for residents of, you know, the North American continent, it wasn't actually true recycling in the way that we thought it was. And it was very misleading as to what our actual recycling rates were. By growing domestic markets through PCR requirements, we believe that we'll be able to manage some demand on one end of it and increase the supply on the other end of it through market forces and have some real recycling occurring. So we've been pretty supportive of that. There's obviously a lot of discussion going on as to what is the right percentage of post-consumer content requirement and what's the right time and, you know, who's going to pay for that, et cetera. But I do expect to see a bill this year, and I expect that we'll be largely supportive of that bill. Another major initiative that we know is coming forward is around organics management. And this is really tied to methane and some requirements in the Climate Commitment Act that was passed last year. The Climate Commitment Act, you might also know as the Cap and Trade Bill or the Cap and Invest Bill or the Cap and Tax Bill, depending on what ideology you come from. But Washington State did pass a pretty robust Cap and Trade Bill last year. Included in the bill were emissions from landfills. Original versions of the bill actually implicated landfills and required that landfills who reported emissions to the Department of Ecology over a certain amount, and I think it was 25,000 metric tons per year or 250,000 metric tons per year. I can't remember the exact number. But landfills that emitted a certain amount of greenhouse gas that they had to report to Ecology would be considered polluters under the bill and would have to buy emission allowances on the auction markets the state was implementing as part of the Climate Commitment Act or the Cap and Trade Bill. We actually advocated pretty strongly to exempt landfills. We felt like this requirement was an unfunded mandate, as counties are the primary, the primarily responsible agency statewide for managing solid waste. We felt like purchasing allowances was just going to have to be a pass-through to ratepayers and would likely cost tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And frankly, there just wasn't, you know, infrastructure and systems in place to handle the waste that actually creates the greenhouse gas emissions from landfills in an effective way in a short period of time that would have been able to, where we would have been able to deploy it and avoid creating those emissions. And not only that, but we have legacy landfills out there that we really can't do anything about unless you want to go and dig up the garbage and handle it in a different way, which doesn't really make a lot of sense, especially when you're talking about trying to limit greenhouse gas emissions or reduce them. What we ended up with in the bill is a couple of things. First of all, we got a 10-year exemption or a 10-year window for landfill emissions. So landfills do not come under the authority of the Climate Commitment Act until phase two or phase three of the act. So there's nothing that we need to do right now. But there was also, and this was kind of unusual, there was also some strong policy intent language embedded in the bill, not in the preamble to the bill, not in you know, discussions about why the bill was needed, but actually into the RCW that states very clearly the state intends to adopt a separate policy specific to landfill emissions within that 10-year window. And if they don't, then essentially the policy just reverts back to implicating landfill emissions in that phase two or phase three portion of the enactment of the act. And again, that's 10 years from 2021. Now, You might ask why landfill emissions were part of the discussion around reducing greenhouse gases and why they were part of the Climate Commitment Act. Well, landfill emissions are derived from organic matter actually going into landfills, okay? Organic matter is estimated in Washington State to be about 33% of the total component of the solid waste stream that goes into landfills across the state. Now, because those landfills essentially exist in an oxygen-free environment once they've been buried, that organic matter decomposes over time. And organic matter can be anything from paper and cardboard and wood products and things like that to food waste, right, which is a lot of it. And so in that oxygen-free environment, when composition or decomposition occurs, it produces methane. And as you know, methane is classified as a short-lived climate pollutant. It is much more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, and it contributes a lot, even though it's short-lived, it contributes a lot to the more immediate effects of climate change that are creating a shorter window, so to speak, for our ability to actually react and make changes to a warming climate. This is all science. Essentially, it's a greenhouse gas that is more potent in that it holds the temperature, the warming temperatures closer to the surface. So dealing with methane actually extends the period of time for us to reach that 1.5 degrees kind of barrier and gives us more time to react to general carbon dioxide and carbon issues in our atmosphere. So dealing with methane is often considered kind of a low-hanging fruit in the battle against climate change and will go a long ways towards the state of Washington meeting its greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. So that's why it's there, and we now know that we have a 10-year window with which to deal with it. So how do we deal with it? There's only really a couple of ways that we know of technologically. There's biofilters, and they're somewhat effective, that you can actually place over landfills that tend to filter out some of the methane. They're used in other areas of the United States and all over Canada, British Columbia, et cetera. There are systems out there that capture methane. They turn it into renewable natural gas. They use it for vehicles or to power or to use for power plants to generate electricity. But those only capture a certain amount. Or you can simply divert organics from your landfill so you don't create methane in the first place. And it appears the state is going towards the diversion strategy and is really focused on organics recovery and specifically food waste, getting that out of landfills and getting out of the solid waste management stream for landfilling and treating it a different way. And by treating it a different way, I mean they've really come up with three strategies. Number one, prevention, right? Trying to stop it from happening in the first place. Number two, recovery. So looking for ways to recover edible food waste and use it to actually feed humans or use it to feed livestock and animals. Or the third, which is to divert it from the landfill and compost it or digest it in another way aerobically. So what does that mean for you? Well, what that means for you is probably some new robust requirements around food waste and around organics and managing it in a different way in your system. There's a bill that was recently passed and is in the implementation stage in California that seeks to do this. And we're trying to learn from California's experience and figure out, you know, how we're going to deploy this statewide. We believe it's going to create a big need for new infrastructure. There are lots of composting facilities in Washington State, but not enough to serve the needs that we believe will be created by these new regulations. In fact, we may need, you know, 5 or 10 times as many facilities as we have today. And as you know, siting and permitting solid waste facilities is not an easy thing to do. It makes you really popular in your community. Everyone wants to give you a badge of honor when you want to put a composted facility in their neighborhood. You know, that's only one of the problems. You know, where are we going to get the money to do it? That's another problem. I just read an article from a California paper. There's a community down there, I think it was called Birchfield, that's looking at this right now, and they're proposing a 71% rate increase for their ratepayers in order to pay for what they believe they need to comply with the new California standard and the new California law. And that's with subsidized money coming from the state in the form of grants and other things to pay for infrastructure and operations. Now, when you're talking about a 71% increase, that's obviously a major increase, right? And we know that where solid waste management is concerned, there's a real price sensitivity issue with clients. When they just feel like it's not worth it anymore or they can't afford it anymore, they just find other ways to dispose of it, usually in ways that are not good for the environment, not good for public health, and not good for government's bottom line, because we end up going and cleaning it up at a much higher cost. So we're very concerned about that, obviously. We're concerned about diverting 30% of our solid waste stream that currently goes across our scales, right, that we get paid for. We take 33% of that away, and that's not going across the scales anymore. How are we going to get paid? What's the revenue stream that's going to replace that? How are we going to maintain our programs and our systems? And how are we going to change the culture across Washington State, and I mean the whole state, around food waste, around food waste management, and around organics? This is a big Herculean kind of thing out there that probably needs to be done, but it needs to be done in the right way, with the right resources, and there's a lot of unknowns. We've been having a lot of conversations with folks in California. There's a lot of frustration. There's two sides to this issue. There's kind of the policy side and the legislative side that says, you know what, we just need to mandate it, and they'll figure it out. There's the other side with the local governments, who are the ones who are now holding the bag, trying to figure it out, going, wow, we did this, we did it too fast, and we don't have solutions. And so that's why we're looking at things like 71% rate increases in our community. We're hoping that that's not, the consequences that we see here in Washington State, and we're trying really hard to advocate for better outcomes and better solutions here. Still remains to be seen kind of how that's going to work, but there's a lot of conversations going on about that right now. I don't expect to necessarily have a robust bill proposal to deal with this year, but I know they're starting to look at things like implementing some food waste prevention and food waste recovery policies around larger producers like restaurants, agricultural operations, and things like that. That's kind of the first tier. But I have heard that there's also another methane bill that's being worked on by Representative Joe Fitzgibbon, who is the House chairman of the Environment and Energy Committee. His opinion and his policy bills carry a lot of weight. And I'm not sure exactly what he's proposing yet. I haven't had a chance to talk with him. But that's a major initiative that we're going to be working with, and that it's going to affect your community a lot in the coming years. It's going to be a conversation that you're going to have to spend a lot of time on. The other one that I really want to talk about today, really quickly, I'm probably taking too much time, Amber. I apologize, but I'll try to be as short as I can, is EPR, or Extended Producer Responsibility, or product stewardship programs. Those are kind of interchangeable terms. Do you guys know what those are? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figured you seem like a very informed organization. I think, Tim, you might have shook your head a little bit. No, essentially it's holding producers of a product responsible for end of life of that product, for the recycling and reuse and management of whatever waste comes out of that product. Okay, we have these in place right now. It's like the paint stewardship bill, or we have electronic stewardship bills, right? But they're looking at expanding it beyond that and creating an EPR program for product packaging. So plastic clamshells, paper products, everything that actually comes in a package of some kind, making the producers responsible for that packaging itself. Now, that sounds like a good idea, and I agree it sounds like a good idea, but just like anything, the devil's in the details. There are programs like this in place in Europe and in British Columbia and in other areas. A really good example of something like that might be the bottle bill that's down in neighboring Oregon and California. They're kind of like mini EPR programs. The proposal is to really bring in a pretty broad, sweeping EPR program for product packaging and for paper products, and to basically implement that across the state in curbside programs for recycling. I don't have a lot of details on what the proposal is yet, because it's being actively discussed right now. The bill was actually introduced last year as the original version of 5022, but it never even got a hearing before it switched to the three components that we talked about before and was eventually passed that way. There's a statewide discussion going on right now with the prime sponsor of the bill, which is Senator Mona Doss, who also championed this program last year. We're very active in those discussions. Our point of view is a couple of things. First of all, obviously, we're really supportive of recycling. We want robust recycling markets. We want to find a way to pay for them because they cost us more right now across the board than we receive in benefits. We want to be honest with the public about that. And it makes a lot of sense to have producers be responsible for the product packaging because there's a lot of waste that goes into product packaging right now that they're not responsible for, that we are paying for. And having them have some skin in the game there, you know, obviously will create incentives for them to be able to produce more packaging that's recyclable and also limit their packaging, which we think is a good thing. Also, product packaging is probably the single largest contributor to the litter control problem that we're having right now, right? Whether it's a plastic lid or it's a cup or it's, you know, one of those plastic ring holders for a six pack or it's a, you know, paper napkin or a paper bag or whatever it may be. This is all product packaging. And these are the things that, you know, you're cleaning up along your roadways and in your parks and along the freeway ramps and other areas and public places. And it's a growing problem in Washington State that, frankly, we really don't have enough resources to handle. Our concerns, though, are we want to make sure a couple of things. First of all, we believe that we have a world-class recycling program here in Washington State compared to other areas, and we don't want to undermine that. We don't want to go backwards. So whatever gets implemented, if it's a new mousetrap, it needs to be a better mousetrap. We're not just willing to accept the status quo or go backwards for the sake of an EPR. Secondly, we want to understand the cost structure. Again, you know, product that goes over our scales, we get paid for. It's how we run our systems. That's how our entire system is based. When you take more and more product off of those scales and divert it for other uses, that's a good thing. We totally agree. But how does that affect our funding models? One of the other funding models that we really rely on that we just made a ton of progress on that I was bragging about earlier, the MACA funds. Well, if you look at the long-term revenue projections for MACA, the Model Toxic Control Act, they're actually starting to torpedo over time. The reason that is because the Climate Commitment Act is going to invest a bunch of money in getting us off of fossil fuels, right? And that tax is paid primarily by petroleum. And if petroleum use in Washington State is going to go down, inevitably that tax revenue is going to go down, and we're going to lose our revenue stream. So a lot of these major initiatives that we're looking at are fundamentally impacting some of the foundations of how we do our work and how we get our resources for solid waste. So there's a lot of complexity there that we're trying to understand, and we're trying to advocate for your programs that really impact what happens on the local level. I think those are the really big initiatives that we're going to see this year. We're probably going to see something around a battery stewardship bill as well. So dealing with batteries with a major focus on not the kind of traditional old style alkaline batteries, but the new ones that you find in your, you know, in your cell phones, right, in your laptop computers, in your vehicles, the ones that are more volatile for whatever reason. I can't remember the name of them right now, but I know you can't put them in your luggage in an airplane anymore because they kind of can blow up in the cargo hold and cause fires, that sort of thing. So there's probably going to be a proposal around that. So far, those are the only major initiatives that I'm hearing about this year, but I would offer that those are probably enough, and that's a lot to try to deal with. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, one more thing. With the Tri-Cities and Vancouver hauling our garbage to Boardman, Oregon, that should affect the Washington landfill setup, and of course at Findlay Buttes, they collect the methane and they power generators and dry your onions and do all kinds of other things there with methane anyway. So is that, we're not a typical Washington County as such then, and also we have glass ability to recycle our glass across to Portland, which is unheard of in the state.
Yeah, so a lot of issues in the statement that you just made there. Obviously, you know, if you're not operating your own landfill and you don't have legacy landfills that are emitting greenhouse gases, then you're possibly a bit more insulated from the Climate Commitment Act and the requirements to offset those emissions with allowances that are purchased on the open market. However, that's only for a period of time. You know, as we know, what happens in California or Washington or in Oregon, oftentimes other states on the West Coast tend to kind of emulate that. And there is a push to try to make sure that these allowance markets, where you can buy essentially carbon credits, are available all up and down the West Coast. I know Washington wants to make sure that California can be involved in our market, and British Columbia wants to do the same thing. I would assume that Oregon will join at some point as well. So, you know, while you may be, you might have a short-term reprieve there, you're likely to see some impact from it in the future if we're not able to come up with some other strategies. As far as the methane capture and reuse, that's a whole other can of worms when you're thinking about organics management, because it's the organic material that actually goes into those landfills that creates that methane that they're able to capture and reuse. Now, that's usually a really good economic driver in a lot of rural communities. A good example in Washington State is the Roosevelt Landfill in Klickitat County. That might even be the gold standard for how this stuff operates. And that drives a lot of jobs and a lot of economic activity in that community. Now, you stop putting organics in that landfill, and they have a 20-year window, essentially, of where, you know, they're no longer able to capture marketable renewable natural gas in the form of methane. And it's not just, you know, a good 20 years of running and then it stops. It's actually a pretty steady decline over 20 years. And so you're going to have some impacts there that community is going to have to deal with. Our question on a statewide level is, well, maybe that's not necessarily a bad way to handle organics. And there's room for, you know, composting, aerobic digestion, and methane capture in landfills where it's appropriate. We're just not sure which one has a better or worse result on greenhouse gas emissions at the end of the day. Composting emits greenhouse gas emissions as well, right? When things decompose, carbon is released, and in this case, it's released into the atmosphere as CO2. Just CO2 is much less potent of a greenhouse gas than methane, right? Methane is 25 to 80 times more potent than CO2. So when you take the methane from a landfill and you clean it and convert it to to RNG for vehicle use, or you burn it for electrical production to power electrical power plants, you're converting it and releasing it as CO2 as well. I just don't know which one is better or if they've actually done studies on that. So there's a lot of questions in what you just said. As far as glass recycling goes, you're very lucky to be that close to a glass recycling facility. There's a lot of our communities that have stopped recycling glass simply because it's essentially an inert item in a landfill, and the cost to transport glass because of its weight and volume to a facility that can recycle it are oftentimes more expensive than they get on the return for the commodity itself.
All right. Any other questions for Paul? Paul, thank you very much. It was very informative and kind of eye-opening in terms of what's coming in the future. Tim, do you have something? I saw you unmute.
Oh, yeah. So we talked about that EPR at the last meeting. And the interesting thing about whenever that is discussed, what it talks about is making manufacturers responsible for the costs of recycling. It seems to me that we're missing the boat there. We don't want manufacturers to continue to have big packaging and make them responsible for it. What we really want them to do is reduce their packaging.
Yeah.
I don't care about having a great amount of packaging and a better recycling system that they pay for. I want to reduce the amount of raw materials and packaging that we're using. And it just doesn't – that is not really discussed when this is talked about.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that a lot of the advocates behind the EPR for packaging proposal What they believe is that just by simply making them responsible, it will create the financial incentive for them to reduce their packaging, make it more recyclable, that sort of stuff. So even if they need packaging or they will need packaging, right, that at least it can go into a cyclical system and be reused, captured, remarketed, that sort of thing. Even though that's kind of the assumption that's being made, there actually hasn't been a prevention discussion as part of this EPR policy proposal. And it's one of the things that we as a group, meaning the Washington Association of County Solid Waste Managers, is trying to bring to the table and point out that any really good strategy around managing solid waste should include as its first alternative, prevention. Right? How do we just eliminate the waste from the system in every way possible so that it's one less thing that we have to deal with? Because no matter how much you recycle, you're going to contribute, you know, greenhouse gas emissions in the process through transportation, through processing, et cetera, right? There's just no way to avoid it. And yeah, maybe it's less than using virgin material, but it still is emitting. And if there are ways to eliminate that emission here, right, and affect our budget in a positive way on this side, then maybe there's another sacrifice over here that we don't have to make or can't afford to make that, you know, is in our interest to do so. So you make a really good point. That's one of the key arguments that we're making and key points that we're bringing up. The other is we really think that if they're going to put together a producer responsibility program for packaging, they need to include some additional requirements for those producers to make more investments in resources for litter control for local communities. There's a litter tax that they pay now, but it's clearly not enough. We don't have the resources that we need. We need more, and it's their packaging that is the primary item that we're picking up. So if you're going to put together a program that makes them responsible for it, they need to be more responsible and take more responsibility for providing resources for litter control as well.
Thanks for spending your evening with us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Happy to do it.
Thank you.
And I threw in the chat about the Oregon DEQ, the Recycling Modernization Act. It focuses primarily on packaging, paper products, and food serviceware. I know that they're looking for a lot of public comment on this and public involvement. As you know, what comes out of one state bleeds into another. So while it is Oregon's legislative rule, it surely could transcend to be Washington. So I would encourage, if you do have interest and knowledge, and having public who has knowledge of the solid waste industry is always really great to provide input, even in that DEQ format. So I put the link in the comments.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate that.
And thank you, Paul. That was a great presentation.
Okay, moving on to our next item on the agenda. We have Pete Dubois with the Solid Waste Management Plan update and where we're at with that. Pete, welcome.
Hey, Kyle. Great. Wow. Paul, that was a whirlwind. That's a lot going on. I will be brief, so I'll be like maybe the intermission here, and then we'll bring on Mike. So I think, Amber, I'm set up to share my screen. Today I wanted to just give a quick overview, really again, on our solid waste management plan and some of the overarching goals, and really, as Travis has put it, kind of our rallying cry, our beacon, so to kind of set us up for the work that's at hand. So we're almost taking kind of a step back here. We were involved with our staff in a vision, mission, values process. So I'm going to run through where our staff ended up with a draft. And then soon after this meeting, Amber will send out a copy of that. So if you've got comments or suggestions, feel free to add that. But I'll just kind of quickly go through where we're at, just so you've got an overview and you feel part of the process, which we certainly very much appreciate you guys coming out on a Thursday night, all of your very esteemed colleagues. And volunteerism. So thank you for that. In the background, we are working away on our six chapters. And as those become more ready, we'll be sharing those either through that committee format. We're still waiting on, we're phase three of three phases, the solid waste management plan. So we've got a lot of work that Mike's been involved with on our whole operation system and looking at some of those capital investments that might be needed over time. That's phase one, phase two, and it ties into the work we're doing. So we're a little bit waiting for some of that. So I'm going to share my screen. We'll go through this real quickly. And as I said, Amber will follow up with an actual one-pager that's got all of this on it. So you please do send suggestions if you've got them. So we'll go through this quickly here. So again, this is the draft vision, mission, values for our solid waste and environmental outreach, which does include our staff. It obviously includes SWAC, our advisory group, and it includes our regional partners and other key stakeholders. So that's really the group that we're looking at that's going to be impacted by this. This isn't something that's going to go out to the general public or be around that at that level. It's a very small level. So just to kind of bring us into really what a vision is, as I've been going through this, it's actually one of the sites I looked at. You know, they talked about, now you've done this for your business and you've come through with your vision, your mission, and your values. Have you done it for yourself personally? And so as we're going through this, I want you to be thinking about that lens as well, because I think there's a lot we can get out of this from that aspect. So really our vision is what we're looking at, our solid waste environmental outreach. What's it going to be in the future? And again, from a personal standpoint, where do I want to be in the future? So I'll just throw that in occasionally. What have we set out to accomplish? It's primarily intended, as I mentioned, for our employees and our stakeholders, which includes all of you. Describes what we aspire to be. And it's simple, memorable, and inspirational. It's a time to dream big and be bold. And so, I'm just going to kind of read through all these slides, and then Amber will be following up. So this is what we have come up with. Our entire staff has been part of this process. So our SWEO vision is, which again pertains to our regional partners and all the way through our stakeholders, residents, employees, and students choose to reduce, reuse, and recycle resources in a world-class solid waste system. And what we're trying to do is be inspired. You know, this is something for our staff, for our stakeholders, for our partners, to show up day in, day out, and really try to make things get to this point. So next up is our mission, and this is really looking at the present moment. This is why we exist, you know, why we have our organization. It's an action-oriented statement, declares our purpose, you know, for why we serve our customers. And the mission that we came up with, it's kind of like the answer is, SWEO mission, educating the community and ensuring that the prevention and processing of their waste attain the highest value and best use. I like when Paul was talking about the methane, you know, do we capture from the landfill? Do we, go about reducing organics through composting? You know, this is some of those key questions that we really need to be asking in our present and our current planning to get the highest value out of this waste and its best use. So the final piece, and I'll read through each of these. These are the values, and this is really how we want to behave as a group. You know, it's kind of our guidelines for decision making. And this is, again, what our group came up with. We serve the entire community. We offer state-of-the-art transfer stations, material recovery, and moderate risk waste facilities. We ensure full access to everyone in the county, especially marginalized populations. We educate so our community understands how the solid waste system works so they can use it correctly. We provide high-quality hazardous waste management options. We measure our programs for success, and we foster partnerships to minimize waste. So that's what I've got for our Swamp Up update. And I think in the interest of time, it would be great just for Amber to follow up with that. It's all nice on one clean page. You guys can kind of take a look at it. And please do share your sentiments if you've got some. Thank you.
I will send that document out after the meeting.
Thanks, Pete. Anyone have any questions for Pete before we move on?
I think he should get an Olympic award for reducing 19 chapters to 6.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a little different than our previous solid waste management plan, so it'll be interesting to kind of compare and contrast the two moving forward. What is that, Amber? Okay, thank you very much. All right, Mike, you're up with our regional system study update.
So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to verify my mic was working. The big news is that the phase one report is out. We've got a summary that comes with that, and we can send that to all the members upon request. The report itself is 11 megabytes and change, and so it's pretty darn big, and we're trying to figure out how we would distribute that to those who want the, you know, the full document. And I would recommend that you, you know, look at it in its entirety and then kind of compare it to the summary so you understand the underlying data and facts that lead to the conclusions in the summary. And so Amber and I were talking about that today, and we'll continue to kind of figure that out. And I think what she's going to do is follow up, and, you know, with SWAC as far as pull people who want the entire document. And then that way we'll either end up creating a website for the plan, regional system study, to where it can be downloaded, or we'll have to set up some kind of a file share. That's how we eventually got it. And the county system did not like JRMA's system, but we were finally able to grab it off the city of Vancouver's. So it was kind of an interesting roundabout way that it got to us. So I, you know, like I said, we've got some technological challenges in getting it to you, but I would recommend that we get it out to everybody. And in the short term, we'll go ahead and send the summary out to everybody. That's pretty easy. That's an 8-page document.
I think 11 megabytes doesn't seem that big for emailing anymore. I'm mailing out 15 megabyte files all the time.
To my knowledge, we have a 10 megabyte cap on our county email.
You guys are in the dark ages still. You need to up that.
Oh, you can't believe how little storage we have. 2 terabyte for the entire division.
So no SharePoint site either, huh?
No, I mean.
Welcome to the next century. You'll get there someday.
I've got a 12 terabyte sitting here that I paid, you know, under $300 for, but the county can't go out and buy us, you know, that level of NAS storage. Don't get me started. Yeah. But anyway, Pete is correct. We are now to the point where phase one is going to drive the drill down into phase two, a lot of which is taking a harder look at the recommendations and deciding which ones to move forward with. And also, in regards to the capital improvement program that we would recommend over the next 10 to 20 years, we needed to kind of as a group drill down and start to talk about that. And but initially, I think that our negotiations with Waste Connections in the, you know, city, county, and Waste Connections are sitting down to talk about some of this now that they've got the studies as well. And I think that will, you know, help drive the scope, because we need to give Jeremy specific timelines of what we think is going to get built when, so they can plug that into the financial models. And so we're a ways away with getting some of that out there. In the next 2 to 3 weeks, I should know more about what our timelines are and be able to get back to you. And I think the one thing, and Tim, you'd brought this up, if we were ready to start talking about the minimum fee, I think some of the short-term things that we'd like to shop to the, you know, county council, I think we should try to get before a committee or the full group. And I wanted to, you know, kind of talk to Pete and Travis about that some more, how we want to approach that with the folks. Because, you know, those definitely are going to, those were talked about in our last plan. Now we've drilled down, you know, we believe they're prepared for formal recommendations. And, but there's got to be a pathway to do that. And generally in past SWAC, we would set up a subcommittee who would review a specific chapter or a specific action. And so that's kind of, I think, what we need to kind of talk to with Travis and Pete and probably Kyle when, you know, Travis gets back from 80-degree weather. And
I heard he decided to stay.
He didn't have cell reception today.
Oh, sure.
So on my last fishing trip, and this is a true story, I was just at fishing the mouth of the chutes, but I drove off without my phone. Whoa. Both phones, as a matter of fact. And it was nice, I got to tell you. I don't think I've been that far from, you know, I wasn't far from technology, but not having that, you know, connectivity was pretty darn interesting. So I think, like I said, when he gets back, we'll get those discussions going, because I know Pete and I both need to start moving some things forward with you guys.
Yeah, and you had brought that up at the last meeting. I mean, there's a note in there that Pete says he wants a SWAP subcommittee for content review to review those six chapters. So what you're saying tonight is a little bit different than what was said in August. So.
It's about the same, but it's I think it's, you know, we're further along now that we've got what I would call a final. And by the way, if you do get into the full, report and you find something that kind of stands out to you, please let us know before we, you know, publish it on the website so we can get it fixed. It was so much for all of us to review that I'm sure we've missed something. And I mean, it's gone through, you know, obviously Jeremy, Rich, Julie, myself, Travis, we've all looked at it until our eyes, you know, glazed over. But that's when you start missing the mistakes. So if you guys see anything, just let us know and we'll get that fixed before we, you know, put it up on the website. But, you know, we're, like I said, we're going to need to do something as far as public outreach for the planning phase anyway. So that's really all I've got tonight. Do you have any other questions right now for us?
I have one, if you don't mind.
No, go for it.
At the August meeting, you asked us to read Chapter 3. And
correct.
So I did. And one of the things that that I'm curious about, you know, in the discussion was a lot about where the efficiencies are, the transfer stations are getting overloaded because of cell falls. It was that discussion. And then there was a discussion about how the cities in Clark County are going to continue to annex and get bigger. And I'm just, is there a population where allowing self-haul is either not allowed or just not practical or not feasible, or, you know, having an optional collection system versus having a mandatory collection system? And I think a lot about Battleground in that regard. You know, if they get to 25,000, are they still going to have a collection system that's optional? Is that really practical?
In my opinion, no. And I think, you know, that these are some of the things we have to shop to the county council. And because even though we're practically 87% of they're already on service voluntarily under a subscription. And you're only going to get up to about 94, I think is about where the city's at, 94, 95. You're not going to get them all.
Yeah.
You look at Battleground and you know, that participation rate is far lower than that. And that just in that general area of the county as well. And so if we could at least get started by having universal collection within the urban services area, and then now we're down to La Center and Battleground, the two remaining cities without it.
Yeah.
I think the sell in La Center is not going to be that hard. The general plan is that Waste Connections is going to start rolling out automated in the cities north of the urban services area, then the urban services area, and I think parts of the rural, but not all of them. And so that's, you know, once they get their carts, to me, there's no real excuse not to say, hey, you know, we've got this nice, easy cart service for you. Why are you self-hauling and storing this stuff in your yard?
Makes a huge difference. Makes a big difference in how you – I'm sorry, Michael.
No.
It makes a big difference in how you think about the traffic issues that you're having at transfer stations.
Yeah, and then there's the fairness issues. You know, I mean, why is it that everybody that has service paying extra to support this self-haul?
Yeah, right.
Well, that's just not really – that's part of the equity issue to me that really drives that need to get everybody we can on service. But, the reality is you will still need places for folks to self-haul. Under the UTC system, the bulky waste concept won't work in the county. You can't just do bulky waste rate. That, you know, isn't based on cost of service and roll it into the over. See, that's what the cities do that have it, like City of Vancouver. Their overall rate includes these free pickups. So they're not really free,
right?
But they get, you know, X number of them for free because it's already built in the rate base.
Yeah. But the way they're not financed by grants, they're financed out of rate still.
Yeah, and the way the UTC works is that it's all cost-based. So if it's $50 to drive your truck out there, you know, $10 to pick up the item, you pay $60, period. And so that's the problem in the county. And so that's why, you know, we're looking potentially at someone doing these bulky waste collections or maybe at the, you know, facilities that aren't so busy. It really wouldn't be feasible to do something like that at CGR. It's just too compact and too crowded constantly.
Right.
But maybe West Van or Washougal or some other central location.
Or the new North County transfer station.
Yeah. Correct. And we are starting to kind of review our Appendix M. And, you know, that's probably going to involve some legal reviews and keeping that pretty internal until we decide on what that all those criteria are going to look like. And there's just a lot of decision making on, you know, siting a facility and who does what. And so we're starting to work on that. But like I said, that's going to be pretty held closely until we have something that we can give you.
Yeah.
I mean, it does require us to do public outreach at a certain point, but, you know, we still need to fully evaluate that internally and what all that means. Those, by the way, were based on what King County came up with from the EPA. So Anita and I did not just make Appendix M up. It came from somewhere. And so I literally just started looking at it a few days ago and with Jeremy. And so we're trying to figure out what it's going to take to not get sued. For those of you who were around last on our last one, we were in land use with Meshuggah for 3 years, and they focused on the siting criteria. So wow. That's why it's very important to get it right the first time. And a lot of it's going to be based on people who know a lot more about planning and legal than I do. So eventually we will come, you know, with here's what we're doing, why we're doing it. But for right now, it needs to be, you know, pretty internalized. Okay. So I think as far as Chapter 3 is concerned, I do want to move forward with, you know, getting some recommendations on that, hopefully by February. But we're working into the holidays, so it may be the February meeting before we set something up and get rolling with that. Definitely want to get something in place by about August of 22, so we could potentially roll it out in with the rollout of the carts and the new rate, 2023 rates. We'll need at least 4 months or 5 months of advertising, so everybody knows it's coming, and the scale house operators aren't lynched, you know. For, I mean, it's going to be a tough transition. They will get yelled at. There will be a lot of not nice people. And so I think that's a consideration here, but it is also one of those things where I've seen it before. You pull off the Band-Aid, you just do it. In 6 months, it kind of dies out.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that people react like that, but, you know, the reality is they were already paying for it if they brought in 300 pounds of garbage. It's just structured differently. And the idea is, it's just mind-boggling how many people bring in 20 pounds of garbage. Just mind-boggling.
I still can't believe it. It's like, I go to the transfer station like once a year for bulky items. I just can't believe that people self-haul 20.
They do.
It happens, so I trust you.
No, I mean, we've got the stats. The scale house data is amazing. And I mean, I just was pulling snapshots, you know, and I just, my jaw dropped. And I had ran, you know, transfer stations for almost 6 years in Lewis County. But it wasn't until I saw the data here that I really realized where the problem was. So I think that's, we're at 745 now.
Mike, can you give us a construction update on your at the Merck there? I see you. They're working on it. How are we doing, and are you happy with it?
On the central?
Yeah.
So they're really close with the finishing the access. Hopefully we get a dry night, and it has to be above like 40 degrees to pave. And so WashDOT's got a standard for paving, and that's it. And so I don't know where we're at. I'm going to get an I thought it was going to be done by the end of the month and or the 20th. So I haven't had a chance to talk to Brian Trepto, the operations manager, to see what's going on. I'm hoping we don't have gravel all winter and have to wait for spring to, you know, finish the paving. But that's construction. And everything has just been incredibly difficult to get. I mean, I've had difficulty getting pipe. I know Tappany had incredible difficulty getting pipe for the 99th Street project. And everybody's behind. So it's, you know, they had something similar going on with getting pipe as well. And that slowed them down. And so there was a change order. Now we're – I actually looked at this just before we got on, and the cones are still up. You can see the cut in the pavement. So it's definitely not done. That's all I know, Alan.
Okay, thank you.
I was just out there yesterday, by the way, and they do – it is all still under construction. Additionally, CTR is planning to replace their compactor December 27th-ish. ask for Brian to send Mike, myself, Travis, kind of an update of what that looks like. But they'll, with the compactor switching out, they'll be down without a compactor for about a month. So they'll be top doing a combination of top loading and then diverting waste to our other facilities. And then immediately, probably about the time they go online, it goes into lot closure. So in addition to all of this road construction mess, they've got other headaches that they're trying to juggle as well. So to be
I've been working with them on community development about tracking the permit for the wall they need to install for the compactor. I thought it was a little later than that they're going to start, and she's right. It goes right into, I know the timing goes right into lock closure. So it's going to be interesting. A lot of top loading during that period.
Yeah, the date's 100% confirmed, but it's looking to, I guess they have another schedule project after ours, so trying to get ours in.
It's going to be interesting for them. Let's just put it that way. But anyway, is there any other questions?
For I love your lighting scheme, Mike.
You like that?
Yeah, glow in the dark.
Gamer look going.
Oh, what? I just when I did that, it was like, what's that? What was that horror movie that was like? They shot for $12 and made all that money.
Blair Witch Project.
There you go.
How could you forget that one?
Oh God.
And then you saw it, you're like, oh, this is just terrible camera work. It's not even watchable.
Well, I've got the same problem. Paul does. If I turn on all the lights, then it just like blazes you out because just the way they kind of set in the house and around me. But anyway, from the other side, I'm kind of done.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to reading that review on the regional system study and hopefully giving you some input on that. And with that, we are down to public comment, which I don't see any people in the public. So we are down to good of the order. Good of the order. I've got one. Rich.
I second.
Alan, go ahead.
Yes, let's close it.
Close the meeting.
I move that we close the meeting.
Okay, we'll motion to close the meeting, but don't leave yet. Alan makes a motion, and I will second it. All approved? All right. Meeting adjourned. All right. Rich, this is your last meeting. You're retiring, I hear.